Thank you very much. Thank you very much, John, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's always interesting when people become nostalgic about the 1960s, and I remember those days very well, and I'm glad that there are a few people scattered around the audience who also have memories that go back that far. Let me say at the outset, because of the things that John said about thanking the committee, as the nominal chairman of the committee, I want to tell you how much we appreciate the work that John himself put into this, but particularly the work that Bill Campbell did in arranging this meeting, and also Julie Flick with him. I think the two of them, as we all know, are the unsung heroes of this organization, and they keep this thing going from year to year and do an outstanding job, and I just think it'd be appropriate that we recognize that right now. Well, it's great to be here in California, the state of my birth, and a number of years ago, of course. That's why I can remember the 60s so well. But it is always very good to get here and realize you're 3,000 miles away from Washington, D.C., and that you're more or less escaped the influence of the Eastern news and journalism establishment. Now, admittedly, the L.A. Times is no great shakes, but it certainly is nice to be away from the dominance of the Washington Post and the other journals of fact and fiction that we find in the nation's capital. As a matter of fact, there's a story about the bias of the journalism fraternity in the United States that some of you may have heard. As a matter of fact, some of you may have heard it from me. But it has to do with two scientists who were working at the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. You know, that's the bureaucracy that we used to call the Weather Bureau. And they were looking through their telescopes, and they realized suddenly that there was a meteor hurtling towards the Earth at such a speed that it would arrive within 24 hours and strike the Earth with such force that all life would be extinguished on our planet. And then the story goes on to relate how this would be reported by the various major newspapers in the country. The New York Times would have on the front page a small box that says, "World to End Tomorrow," see page 14. The Wall Street Journal would have a notice at the top of the left-hand column that says, "World to End Tomorrow, markets will close early." USA Today would have on its front page with full-color charts and with interviews of noted psychologists, an article cover story, as they call it, under the heading, "The World to End, How We Really Feel About It." And then, of course, the Washington Post, in its normal way of handling these matters, would have banner headlines that say, "World to End Tomorrow, Republican Congress Blamed." Well, tonight and tomorrow, we have a chance to get away from the influences of the media and to talk among ourselves and with the distinguished group that's gathered here about this whole subject of California. California and the spirit of America. And I've been asked to talk on the topic, "What Went Right in California, Ronald Reagan and His Legacy." And I promise to do this without the introduction of any imaginary or fictional characters. Now, I think there are several reasons why, as we start this conference, it's appropriate to look at the governance of California during the days of Ronald Reagan and the California experience since that time. First of all, Ronald Reagan's governorship marked an important milestone in the history of the modern conservative movement, as I'll discuss in a few minutes. Secondly, it showed what can happen even in a very bleak political climate, similar to what California appears to be facing today. And thirdly, I think that Ronald Reagan's experience as governor, which are not generally as well known as what he did as president, provides some valuable lessons that are applicable in California as well as the rest of the country, for conservative activists and political figures alike. Now, actually, if you look back, the modern conservative movement in the United States, of which the Philadelphia Society is perhaps the leading organization today, began after World War II. And it began as an intellectual movement. In the 40s and 50s, we had organizations like the Foundation for Economic Education, We had the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, at that time known as the Intercollegiate Society of Individuals. We had academics such as Russell Kirk and Milton Friedman and others on various campuses throughout the country. But primarily it was intellectual in its content and character and in its approach to the issues of modern-day life. And then, of course, in the 50s, there was a new rising star among the intellectuals, and that was William F. Buckley. Bill was a senior when I was a freshman in college. We went to the same school. And I remember when he wrote his first book, God and Man at Yale, talking about the leftward drift of the faculty at Yale University and how they were becoming anti-religious. I had lunch with Bill a couple of years ago, and we thought about that, and we said, now we call that the good old days compared to what's happened since. But after writing God and Man at Yale, Bill then founded the first really popular journal of conservatism, National Review, and about the same time, Human Events began as a weekly chronicle of what was happening among conservatives throughout the country. So the intellectual movement was the first part of the conservative history. In 1964, in the campaign for president, in which Barry Goldwater ran as a candidate and then first for the nomination and then ultimately for the presidency, transformed conservatism in America into a political movement as well. And indeed, as John mentioned tonight, with the emergence of young Americans for freedom, as well as many other similar types of smaller groups around the country, a whole new generation of political activists were mobilized for the Goldwater campaign, and many of the names that you heard later on and saw later on prominently in the Republican Party and in the conservative movement really got activated during that political campaign, which started the political aspects of the conservative movement. And really that same movement in 1964 led to Ronald Reagan running for governor in 1966. In October of 1964, he had given a speech for Barry Goldwater, which raised more money than any other speech during the campaign. And the money for that speech had been raised by a group of Republican leaders, conservative businessmen, here in Los Angeles. And as a matter of fact, they had raised so much money that they were able to afford a nationwide broadcast. The Goldwater campaign said, well, if we have that much money, let's put Goldwater on. They said, we put up the money and we want Ronald Reagan to be the speaker. And of course, it was a tremendously successful thing for the campaign. But more than that, it introduced to Californians and to the nation Ronald Reagan as a major political speaker. So it was after that campaign that these same businessmen came to Ronald Reagan and asked him if he would run for governor of California. And it was this, so it was in fact this Goldwater campaign that laid the groundwork for his ultimate going to become the governor of California. But it wasn't easy, because after that 1964 election, the political climate in California was as bleak and as difficult as it seems to be today. The Democrats held every constitutional office. The Democrats also held both houses of the state legislature. Pat Brown, who was then the governor, that's Edmund G. Brown Sr., the father of Jerry Brown, who was later governor and currently is the mayor of my native city of Oakland. But Pat Brown was an extremely popular governor running for a third term, following the only other governor of California who had had a third term, who was Earl Warren. And Pat Brown looked like pretty much a shoe-in for the governorship, and that's why these men were reaching out for a new face, if you will. The Republicans, on the other hand, were bitterly divided in this state because they had been divided in the Rockefeller versus Goldwater primary campaign of 1964, and there were tremendous rifts within the party that had never healed. And so when these Republican leaders asked Ronald Reagan to run, he protested. First of all, he was not a politician. He was an actor. He had a career of his own, and he was very happy in what he was doing. And secondly, there was already an establishment candidate, George Christopher, the mayor of San Francisco. And up until that time, it was primarily from the northern part of the state that the political leadership of California had come. And George Christopher had already announced that he was running for governor in 1966. Well, the men persisted, and ultimately they persuaded Ronald Reagan to at least look at the situation, and he said he would do it under one condition. If they would finance him for a tour of California, in which he would go from town to town, and this was now the end of 1965, and talk with the various people, political people, people who are interested in politics, and see if there might be some receptivity for him as a possible candidate for the governorship. But he said he wanted to convince people that he was not just an actor speaking lines. And so he would have a very different way of going around. He would not give speeches. He would give beginning remarks of 5 or 10 minutes at each one of these gatherings. And then he would spend an hour answering questions from the people to show that this was not something that had been scripted in Hollywood or anyplace else. Well, he did that, and what he found was that there was tremendous receptivity for his common sense ideas about what ought to happen in California government. And so the upshot of it was that at the end of the tour, he came back and said if they were willing to support him, he was willing to run. Well, the rest, of course, took place. As a matter of fact, when in the spring, in June of 1966, Ronald Reagan surprisingly won the primary election against George Christopher, Pat Brown rejoiced and publicly said he was so happy because obviously Ronald Reagan was the easier of the two candidates to beat since he'd never ran for an election before in his life, whereas George Christopher had been this very prominent mayor of what was then the predominant city in California. Well, needless to say, Ronald Reagan did win in 1966. The campaign itself was kind of funny in one way. Pat Brown, seeing victory eluding him towards the end of the campaign, pulled out all the stops. They even had one ad that sunk to the depths of having a little girl asking about the campaign and someone telling her, well, you know, it was an actor who shot Lincoln, as a means of discrediting the candidate's former occupation. But Ronald Reagan won that election by nearly a million votes. He carried into office not only himself, but unexpectedly the lieutenant governor, the state controller, and the state treasurer as well. Didn't quite reach the winning the either of the two houses of the legislature, but certainly evened up to a much greater extent the balance between Republicans and Democrats in both of the two houses. And certainly also, by that outstanding win of a million votes, persuaded the Democrats in both the Assembly and the Senate that they would have to work with this new governor and could not simply ignore him. One other thing that happened was that in the course of that election, Ronald Reagan unified the party, brought them together in a very unique way. In his campaign organization during the primary, he deliberately left several of the top spots in the campaign organization unfilled, so that when he won the primary, he invited the leaders of his opponent's campaign to come into his campaign in top, very important spots, and as a result, unified the party. And that was the year in which Parkinson, Chairman Parkinson of the Republican Party, working with candidate Ronald Reagan, developed the concept of the 11th commandment, that Republicans don't speak ill of another Republican. And as a result, in the fall of that year in the election, the Republican Party in California was united with the leadership of the new governor. There was one other interesting thing that happened. Some of us were talking about it tonight. With the election of Ronald Reagan as the governor from Southern California, the center of gravity of politics in California shifted from Northern California, which had dominated up until that time, to Los Angeles and the Southern California area, which was the larger population center of California and which has become increasingly important in all aspects of California life, business as well as politics. But it certainly shifted the political balance of power to the South, where it has generally been held from that time forward. Well, in California, Ronald Reagan showed that conservatism, which had been an intellectual and a political movement, could also be a governing movement. And that's certainly what happened under his leadership. His first crisis was rather interesting. And that was when he took office, as he said, he found that the prior governor had drained and looted the treasury. Well, it wasn't actually quite that bad, although it was interesting. Pat Brown did get away with almost everything he could put his hands on. One of the things that the president or the governor then noted when he took over the mansion was that the wine cellar, which had been stocked by the various wineries in California for the use of governors year after year, was vacant when he got there. The previous governor had cleaned that out. But he also found that he'd cleaned out the treasury in a rather unusual way. What they did during the last term of Pat Brown's term in office was to change from accrual accounting to cash accounting. And so what they had done effectively had used 15 months of revenue to pay the bills for 12 months. And so when Ronald Reagan took over in January, in the middle of the fiscal year, he found that there was going to be a deficit at the end of the year, and therefore was required to raise taxes, something he was both constitutionally and politically opposed to, and yet had to, because under the California Constitution, you couldn't go into a new fiscal year starting in the 1st of July with a deficit, and it was a requirement that he would have to raise taxes in that subsequent year in order to make sure that the budget was balanced. There was not time for him to make the necessary cuts in government in order to comply with that requirement of the Constitution. So what he did was, first of all, he had an audit. He called in one of the major, big eight auditing firms and had them conduct an audit of the California books so it would be clear to the public, and then had the audit released publicly, had a press conference with the chairman of the auditing firm, so that it was clear to the public why there was a deficit or would be a prospective deficit and why a tax increase was necessary. Secondly, he, by going to the public, he avoided any criticism personally for the requirement of that tax increase, but then he went beyond that and he vowed that he would cut, squeeze, and trim the state bureaucracy, as he called it, and that the savings that would be gained from cutting, squeezing, and trimming would be returned to the people in terms of a tax refund just as soon as they were able to do that. And then in order to make sure that that in fact happened, he asked all of the businesses in California to contribute two or three of their best people and form them into a businessman's task force of 250 top executives from California's business community. And they went into every department and every agency of state government and made money-saving and efficiency-producing and service-improving recommendations, several hundred of these recommendations, on how the business of California state government could be improved for the benefit of the citizens and for a reduction in the costs. There were a lot of different things. For example, the telephone company provided executives, and they went into the various departments and showed how they could save money on the telephone service itself, how they could consolidate things and make real improvements. One of the things that I still remember was that in 1967, the first year in office, they mailed out the vehicle registration notices in December of 1967 rather than in February when they were normally mailed out for the following year. And a lot of the newspapers all chided that this governor apparently didn't know what he was doing because the notices went out at least 2 months before they were supposed to go out under the normal schedule. Well, the reason they went out 2 months early was there was a change in postal rates on the 1st of January of 1968, and in a state like California with all the vehicle registrations, they saved several hundred thousand dollars simply by mailing the vehicle notices. Ronald Reagan always said that that was one of the best things that he did, because when he ran around talking to people about saving money, he said you could talk about millions of dollars and people's eyes would glaze over. But if you talked about saving several hundred thousand dollars by saving on postage stamps, that was something people understood and appreciated that this new governor was doing something a little different as far as state government was concerned. The result, of course, were tremendous savings, and these savings were returned to the people in a tax refund. The first tax refund, I believe, in the history of this state, and certainly one of the first of any state in the Union. Ronald Reagan thought it would be easier if they would just and ask the legislature to just allow people to deduct 10% on their next income tax statement. But the legislature said, no, they didn't do things that way. So the money was collected, and then refund checks were sent out. Now, from the standpoint of the legislature, that's what apparently you had to do in their bureaucratic ways. The ultimate benefit, of course, was that everybody it made even more of an impression upon them by the fact that they got a check back from the state of California and realized it was the new governor who had made that possible. And this tax refund was repeated twice more during the 8 years that Ronald Reagan was in office as governor. One of the major issues, as was alluded to by John's comments earlier, was the campus unrest that was going on in the 1960s. And of course, it was one of the things that was a major issue in the campaign in 1966. And Ronald Reagan said that his view of the campus unrest was simple. The state's universities and colleges were in the business of education, and they were not there to be centers of unrest and centers of demonstration. He said the purpose of higher education is education, not demonstration. And so, therefore, he took an active role for the first time in the work of the trustees of the state college system and in the regents of the University of California, and telling them that they should do their duty to make sure that the business of higher education continued without interruption, and that they should not allow the radicals to close down the campuses. Now, at the time, California was ripe for a major upheaval. There had been two riots, the Watts riots in 1965 and in 1966, under the era of his predecessor. And in 1967, you had a coalition, a loose coalition, of campus radicals, anti-war activists, racial zealots, and other assorted dissidents who were banding together. SDS was involved, and many other organizations were involved to try to shut down the campuses and to generally promote dissension and unrest and disorder in the cities. Well, Ronald Reagan took a very firm position. First of all, he organized the agencies of state and local government to handle these things and control them at a very early stage so that they didn't get out of hand, as had been the case in previous situations in the state. He had a firm resolve and appointed strong people to the Board of Regents of the university and to the State College Board of Trustees, and then he backed them up personally and indicated that he wanted them to be sure that they carried out their responsibilities. And when it was necessary, he took action. For a brief period, he put the National Guard in Berkeley to control that campus when things got out of hand and quelled that disturbance in a very short time, and sent the Highway Patrol to the University of California at Santa Barbara campus when they decided that they wanted to burn down the Bank of America building there and prevented that bank from being destroyed. He also made sure that the regents and trustees appointed strong administrators to take the place of the administrators who were leaving like flies at the time, unable to cope with what was going on the campuses. One of those that he appointed or made sure was appointed was Sam Hayakawa at the University of San Francisco State College, and who did such a great job of leading other college administrators and showing how you cope with those kind of situations. So as a result, the campuses stayed open, and California did not have the major riots and disorders which plagued so many states with urban centers around the country. As a matter of fact, one of the assemblymen, in order to commemorate the stand that the governor had taken, gave him a plaque that stayed over the entrance to his office throughout the rest of his term. And what that plaque said was what Ronald Reagan had represented in dealing with the unrest, and that was obey the rules or get out. Well, that was the situation in dealing with a major challenge that the governor had at the time. But perhaps one of his most important contributions, not only to California, but to the country as a whole, was the welfare reform initiative that he led in 1970 and 1971. In the spring of 1970, the director of finance, Vern Orr, came into the governor's office and explained to the governor that there would be another deficit in the following fiscal year unless something was done. And so the governor said, well, what are the problems? Where is our money going? What are the major areas that we can cut back or somehow staunch this outflow of state revenues? And the governor said, and the director of finance said, well, there are two basic areas. We had a cabinet meeting at the time. I remember the whole cabinet came together, and the answer was that basically the principal source of the revenue drain was in the welfare program, and a secondary source was in education. So what the governor did was set up two task forces, one to deal with the administrative side of education and to reduce the overhead costs in the educational program in the state, and the other was to develop a program of welfare reform. And he made only two criteria for the task force that he appointed. One is that nobody on the task force could ever have had any experience or anything to do with welfare in their entire career, so they would start from scratch. And secondly, he said they should go about their business as though they were inventing welfare for the first time. If you're going to do it starting from scratch, how would you go about setting up a welfare program? So we got the chief deputy director of the Highway Administration, We got a couple of lawyers from the Division of Contracts and Right-of-Ways. We got a couple of other people who had never had any experience in welfare. Put them together in a room and kept them there for about 6 months until they came forward with a welfare reform plan. Obviously, they had all kinds of access to information and so on. But the whole idea was to come up with something new and without regard to what had gone before, and particularly without regard to what the limitations were by the federal government, which had the regulations which had been stifling the proper administration of the welfare program up till then. And so this task force in December of 1970 came forward with a welfare reform program. The governor took that program and brought it to the state legislature and personally negotiated with the Speaker of the Assembly for a whole week, starting at 8 o'clock in the morning, often going till 10 o'clock at night, just as he had in the old union negotiations when he represented the Screen Actors Guild and was dealing with Jack Warner and the other heads of the studios back in the 1940s. And as a result, negotiated with the Democrats who ran the legislature one of the best welfare reform programs that any state had seen up till that time. And what the result of this program was that the truly needy received increases in their grants, whereas the undeserving and the welfare cheats were knocked off the rolls entirely. And as a result, the welfare budget was brought back into balance. There was no need for a tax increase, and there were no future deficits. And the welfare reform actually became a model for the rest of the country. But it had an impact that went far beyond the state of California, because it happened to take place at the same time that the Nixon administration was trying to develop what they called the Family Assistance Plan, which would have resulted in a guaranteed income administered by the federal government for all those who were on welfare throughout the country. And it was because of the success of the welfare reform program in California that Ronald Reagan was able to go back to Washington to convince Senator Russell Long and the members of the Senate, the Democrat-controlled members of the Senate, that the family assistance program was not the way to go, protested to the president and the then Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare that this was not the way to go. And while they were not convinced, the Senate was, and as a result today, we do not have a guaranteed annual income, and we have been able to have the welfare reform that recently passed in Congress, which would not have been possible had the plans that were set forth in the 1970s gone into effect. Well, that was an example of one of the things that took place here in terms of the initiatives during those early days of the Reagan administration. A similar situation pertained in regard to crime. Crime was going up dramatically during the 1960s. And so the governor asked for a little investigation, set up a task force again on crime, and asked to find out why crime was increasing so rapidly. One of the things that he found was that under the judges that had been appointed by his predecessor, almost nobody was going to prison. As a matter of fact, less than 10% of all the convicted felons in California were ever being sentenced to prison at that time. Well, if the criminals were left out on the street on probation or various other alternatives to going to prison, it's obvious that they were continuing to commit their crimes, and as a result, we had this rapidly escalating crime rate. And so one of the things that the governor did was, and one of, again, a major achievement of his administration, was to start appointing judges based upon their qualifications and based upon their understanding of their role and their responsibility to protect the public safety, as well as to interpret and apply the laws in the course of their duties as judges. His predecessor, Pat Brown, had been noted throughout the state as the appointer of political cronies to these various judgeships as the vacancies came along. Ronald Reagan changed that by having judicial appointment committees in every one of the 58 counties of the state to give him recommendations and also to rate the various candidates for judgeships so that he had a basis on which to appoint the best possible candidates for the various judgeships, as a result of which we had a very different type of judge in California than had been the case up to that time. There was one final initiative that I'd like to mention because it, again, had an effect not only on this state but on the country, and that was his desire to have tax reform. He felt that the real problem with taxes and the fact that taxes had been escalating ever since the end of World War II was that it was too easy for the legislature to pass tax increases often disguising them under one source or another, so that the people didn't realize just how much they were paying, since they were paying to various different jurisdictions throughout the state. And so he organized a special, again, a task force that came in with what was then known as Proposition 1 at a special election that he called in 1973 for a major tax reform, which would have reduced certain tax rates, but more importantly would have required a vote of the people to raise taxes in several of the instances in regard to various types of taxes that were levied by both state and local governments. Now, this, of course, got tremendous opposition. All of the local governments, all of the state employees' unions, all of the teachers' unions, and almost everybody else as part of the establishment raised a tremendous amount of money, and unfortunately, a good portion of the business community, particularly the large businesses, chimed in, and the Proposition 1, the tax reform initiative, was defeated in the special election in 1973. But it struck a spark among the people and started a popular movement that gave rise to an overall movement that resulted in 1978, which with what became known as Proposition 13, which was a tremendous change and a tremendous reorganization of property taxes in California, which still continues to this day. Well, in all of these initiatives, in all of these actions, in all of these responses to crises, Ronald Reagan showed one thing particularly, and that was that he had faith in the people of California. He often went directly to the people to overcome the press, the legislature, the establishment political forces of the state. As one of the observers at that time put it, the chattering classes opposed every one of his initiatives. And went to the people who gave him their support in virtually every case. One great example was in the welfare reform initiative. In the beginning of 1971, when he was about to introduce this program, the new welfare reform initiatives to the legislature, he asked the Speaker of the Assembly, Bob Moretti, who had just taken over as Speaker, if he could address a joint session of the legislature so he could present these welfare reforms. Now, almost never in the history of the state had the state legislature denied a governor a request to address a joint session. But because the Democrats were antagonistic towards this program, because welfare had always been their domain, they refused the joint session of the legislature. Well, once again, Ronald Reagan went to the people and turned that to his benefit and talked about for several weeks in the press about the speech they wouldn't let him give in Sacramento, and instead came down here to Los Angeles to the town hall and gave the speech, which got at least 10 times as much attention statewide as it would have gotten if he had merely addressed a joint session of the legislature in Sacramento. And what he did in the speech, at the end of the speech, he said, "Ladies and gentlemen of California, if you want welfare reform, there's only one way that we can get it together, and that's by you writing your members of the Assembly and your members of the State Senate and telling them you want welfare reform." Well, needless to say, the public responded with cards and letters in enormous quantities so that literally bags of mail were being dragged into the state capitol every day to the offices of the various members of the state legislature. And finally, after about 2 weeks of that, Bob Moretti literally came into the governor's office with his hands raised like this, and he said, "Governor, stop those cards and letters coming." He says, "We'll grant you the introduction of your program." He did, and that led to the negotiations that I mentioned and the successful welfare reform. Well, obviously, during Ronald Reagan's 8 years as governor, not everything went right, and some objectives took longer than others. Tax reform had to wait, as I mentioned, until 5 years later, but the spark had been ignited among the people, and a popular movement was, in fact, successful in 1978. But all through this, the people of California knew that they had a leader who had vision, courage, and perseverance. And others in the United States also knew about this leader. For example, Ronald Reagan's fellow governors elected him chairman of the Republican Governors Association, and with his characteristic action, used that group and reorganized and rejuvenated that group so that before he was through, we had elected new governors, Republican governors, in 32 of the 50 states, the largest number of Republican governors at any one time up until just recently. And of course, it was the experience in California and the acclaim that it raised not only in this state but nationally that gave Ronald Reagan the credibility and the record of success that led to his presidency in 1980. I think there's some lessons, as I mentioned earlier, that can be learned from Ronald Reagan's governorship that are equally valid today. It's true that conditions have changed, and there are new challenges today that weren't present 30 years ago. California is a much different state in the year 2000, or will be in the year 2000, than it was in the 1960s and the early 1970s. There have been some tremendous changes in demographics, in the ethnic and racial composition of the state. There have been changes, obviously, in technology, which both create problems and also create opportunities. We have the state having, and the leaders and political leaders having to cope with the divisive politics of the current president in Washington, who's a specialist in class warfare, who's trying to divide the nation among racial and ethnic lines, and who is employing the politics of envy. And this makes it very tough for political candidates and for people who are trying to put across conservative ethics and conservative principles. And we have economic conditions in California as well as the rest of the nation, which is going to call for new solutions and imagination in providing opportunities for economic growth, for the creation of jobs, and there is overall the need for better education in California as elsewhere. But I believe that the lessons from the Reagan era in California point the way to meeting these challenges also. First, because what we need is a positive agenda with clearly identified and defined goals based on sound principles, such as those which Ronald Reagan addressed when he called for common sense government, for reducing the size and cost of the state bureaucracy, for reforming the areas of crime, welfare, and higher education, and when he called for reducing the tax burden and reforming the tax system, as well as when he went forward to provide for a fair and effective judiciary. A second lesson that I think can be learned is the importance of communicating that agenda to the people in a manner that they understand and appreciate that it is in their own interests to have that agenda adopted as the policy of the state. If you look at one of the major problems in the last election in California, and I know other people will be talking about these things, it was the inability of the candidates, the conservative candidates, to put their message across in terms that people understood and that people appreciated in terms of their own interests and the interests of the state as far as they were concerned. Thirdly, and this is one of the things that Ronald Reagan did all the time in every one of his many speeches as well as his weekly press conferences, we need to continually educate the public on the validity and common sense of conservative principles like limited government, individual liberty, economic freedom and free markets, and safer communities. These are the kinds of things that political people have to, again, talk about so that people understand that when you're promised, as we are every Saturday in the president's speeches from the White House, in which nothing is too trivial for him to make a federal case out of, that there is a cost when the federal government takes over a particular function or a particular service, and the people who are paying that cost, both in terms of money through taxes as well as in loss of freedom, are the people of California, as well as the other states of the Union. And the fourth lesson I think we can learn from the Reagan era is the importance of perseverance, the unwillingness to give up despite opposition from the press or the legislature or the political establishment, and to keep coming back again and again to the people until a particular objective or a particular goal is attained. Well, California government in the years 1967 through 1974, became an imaginative, creative laboratory of democracy, as the states are often referred to. The leadership of Ronald Reagan showed that conservative principles worked in practice and benefited people at all levels of society. That's why what went right in California in that era, I believe, provides both an example and an inspiration for what can be done in the new century, not only in this state, but in the nation. Thank you.